Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Good afternoon to you, Michelle.
Afternoon, John.
Michelle, good to talk to you as well, and thanks for getting in touch with Liveline as well today. Michelle, how are you feeling today when you hear Donald Trump in the news talking about autism and talking about Tylenol, paracetamol, as we know it here, and saying things that we know are unproven?
Yeah, I was gutted. I was somewhere between gutted and hugely frustrated. We have two sons, Connor and Dara. They're 17 and 15 now. And for a long time, I thought we were past, this type of misinformation. And to hear the coverage and the discourse around autistic people that's been generated by these comments, it's so disappointing. And frankly, it's dangerous.
Do you ever feel like, here we go again?
I do, John, I really do. Look, families who have an autistic member, life is a constant series of challenges. And on a day like today, I feel like I have bigger fish to fry. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of things going on in our life all the time to support the lads. And then having to, I suppose, refute, rebut, explain what is happening with this information that has been shared. It's another barrier, you know. I mean, we work very hard. Our lads, we dote on them. They're loved, valued and cherished family members. Mm-hmm. And they're really members of their local community here in Ennis. But to hear the way that autistic people are being spoke about as almost a problem that needs to be solved, I think it's really 10 steps backwards in terms of, an inclusive community and making sure that everybody who wants to be part of the community is supported.
Tell me a little bit more about when you say you have bigger fish to fry and you have a lot to do. Tell me a little bit more about life with Connor and Dara.
Okay. Well, I suppose they're men now. And when I heard the information this morning that was shared, I really reflected on how difficult it is in the early days for parents who would receive a diagnosis and, you know, that steep hill that you climb in terms of learning everything you can about autism to best support your child, and how unhelpful then it is to have this type of information, misinformation piled upon you at that stage. Now, I have found throughout the lad's life, every single step of the process has been a fight, you know, a fight for an early diagnosis, a fight for an appropriate school place and transport. You fight for a therapeutic support like speech and occupational therapy, and access to respite and day services. And I mean, we find ourselves at a point now where Connor is turning 18, and it is as though everybody realizes there are autistic children out there, but nobody is planning for the autistic adults that are coming. It's as though Connor has been on an 18-year waiting list, and suddenly it is a surprise to services that he is coming along. Mm-hmm. So there is a constant and ongoing challenge in terms of trying to have the lads' needs met. They're both very different characters. They both attend a special school in Galway called Obatha, which is amazing. And they would both have very different sensory challenges. So they are nonverbal. And because Dara, our youngest son, is so averse to sound, we don't really operate as a family unit, as a foursome. You know, we would always have to drive two separate cars to bring the lads anywhere, or keep one boy upstairs and one boy downstairs, or
that's very
one
difficult,
boy outside,
Michelle,
in the car.
These two boys,
yeah.
The two men, as you said now, the lads, but keeping them apart is very tough on family life.
It is. I mean, they're gorgeous boys. They're doted on by our family and our lovely neighbours here and friends. But it's very difficult, I mean, not to play a sympathy card, but it is very difficult. You know, we don't get to experience any of the typical things that I would see my siblings or my neighbours getting to enjoy, any time the kids are out of school, it's a very stark reminder as to how different our family is. You know, there are no family holidays. You know, we don't get to enjoy anything together. And in fact, when they're out of school and they're out of their routine, it's extraordinarily difficult because they get up every night around 2:30, maybe 3 o'clock, and then they're up for the entire day. So when they're out of school, you can find yourself facing into a 20-hour day, you know. So on school days, it's perforated. You get that break in between. But yeah, you know, I think, you know, when you're constantly in a fight or flight mode, either trying to care for the lads here at home or fight for services, and then you hear this morning on the radio, I was just crushed because there's so many more things that could be done in terms of supporting autistic people. And then I see the coverage that all of this gets and the time and money that would probably be spent, which could be better spent, you know.
And you mentioned your lads are nearly men now. But I'm thinking for parents out there, Michelle, like yourself and your husband, and for many other parents who've been through what you're talking about, it must take you back to those early years when you get an autism diagnosis or you see the signs. And can I ask you, as a mother, does it make you ask yourself questions in the way, unfortunately, President Trump has raised those questions?
Oh, I was hugely saddened, you know, to lay the blame at a pregnant mother's feet, you know, that anything she could have done during pregnancy may have had a causation. And for us all to know that these claims are totally unproven at present, it's so unhelpful. And frankly, for some parents, it's devastating. You know, if you're coming to the realization and the acceptance that your child is autistic, it's an extremely difficult journey. And it brings a whole raft of emotions that each family will deal with differently. But what you certainly don't need is rhetoric that would lead you to believe that anything you did that it would have had anything to do with the mom. You know, I mean, all of the large scale studies in the past have shown that there's no robust scientific evidence to support anything like this. So, you know, I would say to all the moms out there and dads to stick with a trusted autistic centered resource. Like as I am here in Ireland,
yes.
You know, something like that, if they really want to find out information that can support them and their child.
And as you mention it, because I've been reading up on their information regarding misinformation, is where they've put out statements recently. And just to point out, they make it very clear that autism is a natural variation in human neurology. And there are not more autistic people now than in the past, but there are more people accessing diagnosis. And I want to be very clear about that. We heard the HSE's Colm Henry on the news at one as well, speaking of no links there. We hear the European Medicines Agency saying there's no new evidence here, and the World Health Organization as well, calling into to question anything that President Trump or his health spokesperson Robert Kennedy has put out there as well. To the women out there asking those questions now, to pregnant women out there as well, Michelle, who are already so careful about anything they put in their bodies, what would you say to them?
I would say, as a mom, I am not a medical professional. You know, I am a mom first and foremost, but, you know, autism has forever been part of the human condition. And as mothers, we do everything in our power, both while we're pregnant and afterwards. You know, we would do anything for our children. So I certainly would not be taking any advice from somebody who isn't a qualified medical professional. You know, any comments made by the president or indeed, you know, his health secretary, I would be extremely dubious about on a personal level. I would be talking to my trusted GP and medical professionals that you can trust.
I want to bring in some other speakers on this as well. 51551 for your text. Stay with us, Michelle, please, if you can. Laura, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Laura, how do you feel about President Trump's statements on Tylenol or paracetamol and autism? Totally unproven, unfounded claims. What do you make of it?
Look, I think yesterday's announcement, it presented a causal narrative that the current totality of evidence doesn't support. And we know this. I mean, this is not new research. I mean, this is like wrapping today's news in wrappers of fish wrappers from 10 years ago. This is not new information. And he's dredging up things that have been disproven. He's wrapping a causal relationship as which is only a correlational one, and it's not proven. When we look at all the other factors, it is not proven. So I think it's fear-mongering. I think it's sensationalist, and I think it's really, really scary for parents out there, particularly those who don't have any information about autism, who don't know what autism is. It's scaremongering.
I like the way you use the term. He's trying to wrap things up. He's trying to wrap up various wars around the world as well, and things that can be done simply, and things he can solve issues like this, which you as parents know are not easily solved, and there may not be answers sometimes for it. Will you tell me, Laura, about your girls?
So I am an autism consultant myself. I was identified as autistic at 40, but I was already 20 years in services when I had my identification. My eldest girl is 8. She's affectionately known as Big Boss, and she is autistic, and she's also ADHD and hypermobile. And she's a chip off the old block. And when I was pregnant, I can remember the only time I took paracetamol was when I was in labour. And I remember laughing about it because I was like, this is going to do nothing for me in labour. But I had seen all that
Sorry, Laura, you were in the pains of labour and someone said, do you want a paracetamol?
Paracetamol was what I was offered when I first went into the hospital.
Did you punch him?
Not exactly. But I knew that research. I was aware of that research. You know, being in the field, I knew all of this. You know, I lectured in UCC for 10 years on interventions and supports across the spectrum, across the lifespan for autistic individuals in the Diploma of Autism Studies.
Right.
So I know all this research and I know it's been debunked. I know larger studies have come out and said that this is at best correlational, it's not causal. And the difference between correlational and causal is very simple. It's like, think of umbrellas and rain. If you see lots of umbrellas, you can assume it's raining, but the umbrellas didn't cause the rain. And that's kind of what they're saying here, is that paracetamol caused autism, but what we don't know is the reason that the person needed paracetamol in the first place. You know, there's lots of other things. And when we take genetics into play, when we take sibling studies into play, it doesn't hold true.
And that's what the World Health Organization is telling us. That's what the European Medicines Agency and the HSE are telling us today. I should point out, not to make light of someone offering your paracetamol, it's important to treat fever as well during pregnancy, is what the doctors are telling us as well. So they do serve their purpose, obviously. Laura, can I ask you about your own diagnosis?
So I'm quite public about it. I had a breakdown after the birth of my second baby. She's now 6, she'll be 7 in December. And I think that set me on a path of recovery. And in that, I kind of had to face a lot of home truths. We were also in the midst of COVID, and a lot of reflection was done. And I had always felt different. Feeling different was nothing new to me. I'd always felt different. And I just assumed that I was just really bad at being neurotypical or holistic, as they'd say. And that everybody else was just getting on with it.
How were you different,
Laura? I thought I was feeling bad? Well, I was extremely anxious. I had a lot of difficulties around friendships. I had a lot of difficulties around socialising. I'm very direct in my communication, and I got in trouble probably for that a lot as well, because I'm quite firm in my truths, we'll say. And there was just lots of ways in which I found the world a lot harder. And then I think having that breakdown, which I now recognise was likely a mix between postnatal depression and severe autistic burnout. I then booked my assessment in the April with a psychologist here in Cork, and I had the assessment done in August, on the 12th of August, 2020. And I celebrate that day every year because I genuinely think it saved my life. It has given me so much more insight into why I struggle. I've never been more mentally healthy since I found out.
And you feel better because you know what it is.
Absolutely.
Or something to call it. Or is that because you now know how to react to those situations, or maybe sometimes
exactly.
How you can't?
It's just kind of like looking at your life through a very different lens that makes it much, much clearer. And given that I was working in services and I know the advice I would give other people, but I never applied that to myself because I didn't have that piece of paper. I felt different, but it wasn't concrete for me, we'll say. And it was actually reading Jennifer Cook's book, Autism and Heals, cemented it for me. When you go to the chick list and that, she has a list of traits for women. That cemented it for me and I booked the assessment then. But it's 5 years now and I celebrate every single year. And since my identification, my daughter has been identified and she is doing absolutely amazingly, but we raise her to be extremely proud of who she is. And she is very informed. She's excellent at self-advocating for her needs and expressing herself. She's amazing. She's doing amazing because we're focusing on her strengths. Now, I'm not sugarcoating autism. It's not easy to be autistic in a world that isn't built for you. I'm not sugarcoating it at all. And, you know, working with clients myself, I see the hard parts of autism every day. But what I always say is that I choose to focus on my strengths, because if I choose to focus on the stuff that I find hard, that's all I see. If I choose to focus on the stuff my daughter finds out, that's all she'll see. Whereas we want her to focus on her strengths and build her resilience that way.
I think, Michelle, can I ask you on that or bring you back in there when Laura, it's great to hear it's something to celebrate. I think what people struggle to understand about autism is the broad spectrum, because you, Michelle, it's good to hear. I'm thinking that, you know, autism is something to celebrate. But for Connor and Dara that you mentioned, very different needs, needing a lot of extra support. But like what Laura said as well, the world isn't built for them. How do you feel about that? Well, we're celebrating it and we can talk about it. For your boys, they can't.
Yeah, while they are both, Dara can communicate. He uses a communication device, and he's actually an excellent nonverbal communicator. I agree. My lads face different challenges, and every autistic person will face different challenges when they go out there in the world. I think the key is, a little bit of understanding from the community and appropriate supports to be put in place. And that makes everything accessible. We recently have taken part, we'll say, for example, in an inclusive surf program in Lahinch, run with West Coast Surf Club. And because they made appropriate accommodation for autistic kids, we had 20 kids surf all summer, supported one-to-one, who simply could not have done that without the appropriate supports. So I think it's all about meeting the person or the child where they're at, making sure that they have appropriate supports. And then the world is really your oyster. It isn't to take from the challenges that my lads might have or other kids encounter or adults, but certainly a community who understand that this person is autistic, they may need some accommodations to make things work. That is the key to. I think a complete life within your community. It certainly is for us.
It's 0818715815. Amanda, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Amanda. Thanks for talking to us as well. Tell me a little bit about your situation and your reaction to what we're talking about here and, of course, what President Trump had to say.
I think listening to Laura and Michelle there, I'm very much on the same page as the two ladies. And I suppose the key phrase sticks out to me in relation to what both parents and indeed Laura, as an autistic person, has said. And that is essentially that stigma fuels both the culture of blame and the culture of cure. And I think in terms of what Donald Trump has said, that is exactly what it is. It's stigma, his own misinformation or misview on what it is to be autistic or what does the word autism even mean to him or to anyone that, for whatever reason, supports him. I feel that if that individual, when he fully recognises the platform that he has, that it's literally lethal what he has, provided to the community at large across, I suppose, the globe in relation to what he said in terms of autism and in terms of parental, I suppose, blame, in terms of you know, paracetamol, it brings me a little bit back to, I don't know if you're aware of an author, or in fact he was a doctor as well, Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, back, I believe it was 1967, he wrote a book called The Empty Fortress, and he referred to mothers like myself, I'm an autistic mother to four autistic children, and he referred to, I suppose it was a phenomenon that unfortunately came off the back of his book that was referred to as the refrigerator mother. We're back in the 60s, he produced this book, and it unfortunately was taken up by society as a truth or a mistruth. And would you remind us,
I'm not sure we should give it a much of an earring, but what he was implying?
He was implying in the same way that, I suppose, unfortunately in 2025, Donald Trump has once again kind of brought the same stigma to the furrow. And what he said was that essentially mothers that didn't have that mothering, loving instinct were the cause of children, again, this is language I wouldn't use, children having autism. So mothers were blamed and children were institutionalised off the back of, I suppose, what we now thankfully recognise was his discredited theory.
How hurtful, though. How hurtful.
Yeah, but if you think about it, though, I suppose, John, in 2025, you know, here we are again, if we're looking globally at what Donald Trump said, if we're looking at the misinformation that was provided in the Iraq just recently, you know, in relation to vitamins and autism, I can only tell you, I suppose, first and foremost, always as a parent, I recognise my four autistic children as incredibly formidable. They grow up, I suppose, in a world that unfortunately is not always accepting of difference, whether it's out in society, whether it's, I see it on social media myself every day. It's a very difficult thing to live in a world when you're different. It is a very difficult thing. And not because you are different, but the world is not always so accepting. It's very difficult as a parent to navigate the world for my children, knowing, because I experience stigma myself when I speak on culture. I experience that stigma as a human being, but my children have as well. My eldest autistic child is almost 18, but my eldest son, Connor, was the youngest child in County Mayo identified, I use the language of identification, identified as autistic way back when. He was identified, or you might be more familiar with the language of diagnosed, and being diagnosed as, the old language was having autism. So he was diagnosed as being autistic. And the way that Connor was diagnosed or identified as being autistic was that I had to bring him to casualty for a co-occurring difference. But when I brought him to casualty that day, my son would struggle with sleep, and he hadn't slept at that point for almost a year. And right. I brought him to casualty. I was exhausted, and I literally had to tell, you know, the wonderful admin team at, you know, that service desk in casualty, that they could literally have me arrested, but that I wouldn't leave the hospital unless they could tell me for the final moment what was different about my son, because I could see that he was vastly different. I'm one of 11 to any other child that I ever supported my parents in raising. I was the eldest girl, but I knew that he had support needs, but if they could just tell me. But again, that goes back to maybe misinformation that had been maybe provided to, mm-hmm. say, GPs and whatnot at the time, where they didn't have the best information on autism, where they just saw maybe a tired mother bringing a child in and out that was struggling. My son was struggling not because he was autistic. He was struggling because the world around him hasn't been, I suppose, created for individuals that are different. And that's where that comes back to that stigma, that judgment. And that judgment that that's why I say my children are formidable. To live in 2025 when we have, we'll say, members of the Oireachtas, you know, speaking mistruths, when we have the head of the US saying that it's literally, again, back to that Bruno Bettelheim, the empty fortress theory on refrigerator mother, that it's baseless information. And as Laura referenced and as Michelle referenced, this is not evidence-based information. This is, it's actually, I would call it lethal. What he has said is lethal. I would say what was said in the Oireachtas recently was lethal, because there will be an impact. There will be individuals that don't have access, say, to the likes of the excellent As I Am. Yeah. And, you know, they have an incredible support network there. I think it's supportedasiam.e. Again, and I know Michelle referenced it as well, if any families or any individual that's worried about what was in the media, please do contact their support line. But again, people that don't have that access to that information will take that on board. There will be mothers in Ireland today that will worry because of, again, not because they aren't incredible mothers or going to be incredible mothers, but because they will have heard of the stigma around autism, that mistruth, those misinformation, and they will be afraid because they might have relatives or friends that will have also heard of that misinformation, that culture of stigma, that dehumanising way in which people that are different are viewed. And they will unfortunately take on that information. And the same way that Laura rightfully took medication when she was, you know, about to deliver her incredible child, there'll be people that need medical health support and will not access those supports now through medications such as paracetamol. And there's also, on the back end of what was said in the Oireachtas in relation to vitamins, there's also a hypervitaminosis, where some parents might misconstrue what that information was provided by the member of the Oireachtas, may overtake vitamins or may over-provide vitamins to their children. So I suppose what I'm really saying is that individuals that are platformed with power need to be held accountable for this mistruths and misinformation that provided, because it's going to have a lethal impact.
And call it out, as you are doing, Amanda. What do you say to those mothers who are worried today, or those people who do not have the access to all of this information and may not understand autism as you do? What do you want to say to them?
I think go back to 1967 and just think about that information was found to be unfounded. Unfortunately, we're now in 2025 with this misinformation. Parents are struggling enough in this country, and I can say this as a parent to four autistic children, trying to navigate a very unhelpful with the healthcare, educational, we'll just call them all the systems. Very, very complex. For what reason, I don't know. But what I will say is that parents listening, please do not blame yourselves. There's no blame to be had. Your child was born different. They've always been different. It's just now it is a great thing to have that information about your child. I am glad to know that my children are autistic. And I say I'm glad to know because that means as a parent, I can support them correctly. Nothing I did or didn't do made my children autistic. They were born autistic. Their brain type, their neurology is autistic. They are formidable human beings because they are living in a world where world leaders are quite literally blaming their neurodivergence, their brain type, on the fact that a parent, when they needed support, took paracetamol. What we actually need to do is not detract from the actual issues at hand, and that families in this country in particular are not being supported on any of the different systems through which they try to access. Autistic people are being devalued, are being, as I said at the very start, that stigma of culture, are being stigmatised because of their differences, not because of them themselves, that misinformation out in society, those barriers that autistic people like myself, like my children face. I worry every single day, and I said this recently to a friend, that I worry for, and this might sound like a morbid thing to say, but I often think if I could just live a few days longer, I hope my children reach, you know, I hope they're some of the oldest people that grow to live in this country. But I would love to think, would it be possible that I could live a day longer than all of them? Because I would be so, so afraid of the world they're going to grow up in without me supporting them.
It's very upsetting, isn't it? What every parent worries about, really, Amanda, when you have a child with an additional needs like that.
Well, it is, but it shouldn't be. Why is the system so complex for children that have needs that are identifiable early on in their lives? Why can't the system support our families? Why do families have to, you know, go to extraordinary lengths just to access the bare minimum of supports? Why, you know, I'll often hear families say, you know, it's who shouts the loudest gets the most support. But the thing is, why should any of us have to shout the loudest? Why can't, with the individuals in power, you know, really provide the correct supports at a human level for our children? Why are they seen as other by virtue of the fact that, you know, they have a diagnosis or identification of whatever the neurodivergence is? In my own family context, it's autism and intellectual disability. Why is it okay? Like, is it right and is it fair? Is it equitable? It's absolutely not. How can I, when you say, you know, for anyone, say, listening to the call today that doesn't have a child that's, you know, different or doesn't have a child that's, you know, has a diagnosis, when you get to hug and kiss your child and say, you know, sweet dreams, what you're saying to them is sweet dreams, the world is your oyster, anything that you want is achievable, anything that you would like to gain in life, I'm going to help you as a parent. When I say that to my children, I mean exactly the same thing, but I know that that isn't possible for my children, and not because I haven't tried as hard as I physically literally have all the days of their beautiful life since they've been born, but it's because of the systems that are, you know, put in place to block their opportunities in life. It's because of individuals that have, for whatever reason, gained power and platform, like Donald Trump, that individual in the Iraq just recently that provided misinformation of vitamins. Individuals like that should be held accountable. Families should be supported correctly. Families in this very context right now, listening to the show today, that are saying, well, what can I do? I've got that information. I'm very worried. Absolutely contact The Incredible Inclusion Ireland. Absolutely contact The Incredible As I Am. I believe it's support@asiam.ie. They have an incredible team there in As I Am that will have excellent information and support. There's Adam Harris, there's Fiona Ferris, two incredible individuals that are lighting the way forward for all autistic people, such as myself and my own children, that we really need to be listening to autistic people. Autistic voices need to be in the room where these conversations are being had. Autistic organisations that are autistic-led, such as I am, need to be in those rooms navigating for families. Mm-hmm. Autistic families need to be in the room, and parents that are advocating for their children, their voices have to be heard and they have to be supported.
And those that are in power need to listen to you, Amanda, and Laura and Michelle, because you're speaking loud and clear and really educating us all today. You must be exhausted having to do this for so long for your own family, and to feel like you have to do it for others, and to feel like you have to tell the world because of the misinformation that's been thrown your way so many years on.
I think for myself, you just do what you have to do for your children, because my heart and soul, I always say, somebody said to me recently, what are you guided by in faith? I said, I always say I'm guided by love. I'm guided by the children that I love, that I adore, that I've done, hopefully, everything that I can for. But I'm also guided by the love that I have for all of our communities, all of the parents across Ireland, all of the incredible children, all of the incredible teenagers and adults that are autistic, that have intellectual disability or do not, all of those individuals should be treated with the respect and the dignity that they deserve, and they should not have an individual such as Donald Trump potentially lethally impacting both their parents' lives and their own lives and the future of all autistic people and families across Ireland and into the future.
Hear, hear. Well said, Amanda. Thank you very much to Amanda and Laura and Michelle. We've lots more people getting in touch with us on this. 51551, please.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Dr. Austin O'Carroll, good afternoon to you.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm well, and thanks very much for joining us. When you hear the mothers talking to us today about this blame, about these myths that had been debunked many times over the years and that are raised again by one of the most powerful men in the world, Amanda telling us there about the lethal damage it does for her, for her children, for other families, for our health services. What do you think?
First of all, I mean, I think we all know President Trump has a habit of making claims that are highly dangerous. Mm-hmm. Bringing back, he recommended that we start injecting bleach for treatment of COVID. He also recommended the use of a drug that's used in malaria, hydrochloroquine, for treatment of COVID, which actually has been found to have no effect and, in fact, may cause higher death rates among people who are treated with it. So his recommendations in the past have been scientifically crazy, to be honest. And so you need to be careful when you hear any recommendation on health from him. So that's the first thing. And second thing is that, I mean, just to clarify, there was some research done a number of years ago that queried there might be an association between paracetamol usage and neurodevelopmental disorders, which includes autism and ADHD. However, two things. Firstly, that research was conducted by someone who was actually involved in a legal case for parents who were claiming this was a cause. So that meant the person who wrote the article was biased. And secondly, since then, a very robust piece of research, which included many, many children, has found absolutely no association between paracetamol use and both ADHD or autism. So scientifically, this is absolutely clear that paracetamol does not cause them. Keep parents who are pregnant and maybe worried need to understand that there is no association between autism and paracetamol usage.
And no link, as you said, we're hearing it from the HSC, from the European Medicines Agency, from the World Health Organization. And the last thing we want is women blaming themselves for anything that has happened to their children here or having guilt surrounding this.
Absolutely. And I also need to mention that I have another association with this. My mother, I have thalidomide. Mm-hmm. So my mother took thalidomide. She took two tablets. And as a result, I was born with significant disabilities. And I'm a member of the Irish Thalidomide Association. And again, many mothers had taken drugs which caused their children's disability. And we know the guilt that they felt, even when they discovered that it wasn't their fault and that they were unaware of it. You still have a tendency to feel guilty when you think this happens. So even though I have been a victim of someone taking medication during pregnancy, and I am very wary of the use of drugs, both in pregnancy and outside pregnancy, and I often will not prescribe drugs that I think aren't warranted, either due to being unsafe or not very useful, I still believe, you know, I still totally accept that paracetamol does not cause autism. So I have plenty of reason to think otherwise, but I totally endorse the idea that paracetamol is safe in pregnancy. And absolutely the issue of guilt. And I saw it in my own mother. She felt guilty. Now she moved on from it. And
was it something you talked about, Austin?
We did. And I said, how did you feel? And she said, well, initially you feel guilty. We didn't know what was happening, what caused this. And she said, so I did feel guilt. And even when I found out, she says it was there. She says, but I just decided I needed to get on with it. And I know a number of mothers adopted the same approach. Other mothers felt more guilty and it affected them and they had to live with that guilt. You know, there is always, you know, likely, you know, misogynist thing that we sometimes blame mothers more for how children turn out than fathers. Mm-hmm. Even in science, and so that does exist in our society. So mothers are existing with that in the background, and then on top of this, they have this issue that they took a drug which caused this. Even though they know in their minds it's not true, emotionally they still felt guilty. Yeah.
And in the case of thalidomide, as you mentioned with your mother, well, this was a very different time too, but it was women acting on the advice of medical practitioners like you are now as well. We know how worried and how seriously you take this advice. There could be a lot of women out there worried today. What do you say to them about paracetamol? Because as I mentioned earlier on, I mean, there's still obviously it's required for the treatment of fevers, and someone could have the cold or flu or COVID or whatever else during pregnancy as well. So what do you say to women who are worried?
I think, first of all, thalidomide, don't forget, came along when we had no protection there was no realisation that drugs could cause problems in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was because of thalidomide that they introduced stringent controls for the testing of drugs, including for women who are pregnant. So it's very rare now to find drugs that potentially can cause damage where we don't know it and there aren't warnings about it. So with paracetamol, as I said, the evidence, the recent study done in Sweden, clearly shows paracetamol is safe. And if you need to use it for pain or for fever or for any issue that relates in pregnancy, it is totally safe to take and it does not cause harm to babies. That's clear and categorical.
Rachel, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Harry.
I'm well, Rachel. Thanks for joining us as well. Tell me what your thoughts on this.
I actually think it's a very, very dangerous time. You know, I've been listening to the other speakers, and to be honest, you know, I'm absolutely in awe of them all. I have two children also on the autism spectrum. I have three children, two are on the autism spectrum, one isn't. I think it's dangerous, and not just for the neurodivergent community. I think it's very, very dangerous for the likes of vulnerable women, vulnerable mothers with newborns. You know, you're putting this out on mothers with newborns. If a child gets a fever, and it, you know, the only way of getting it down is a paracetamol. You know, what happens when a mother doesn't do that? You know, a child will end up with a febrile convulsion. They're ending up in hospital. It's going to do a lot of damage, not just to the neurodivergent community. It can do a lot of damage all around. And then you're going to have a mother that is, as at our most vulnerable, exactly like what we are after being saying about feeling guilty. You know, I'm like that. I always feel guilty about how my kids are. But at the end of the day, I love them. I accept them. I know it's not my fault. I know it's just how they are. But there's always that kind of guilt there. Do you know that
you
way?
You like, always feel guilty, Rachel.
Yeah, you know, you always.
Why?
I think as a mother, you just kind of have that thing in your head and in your heart kind of thinking, God, you know, was it me? Did I do something wrong? You know, and to be honest, I'm at a stage now where I've been able to get counselling. I've been able to kind of look at myself and say, you know, this is nothing I did wrong. This is just my kids. And to be honest, today, I wouldn't change one thing about my kids. I really wouldn't. I wouldn't change a thing about them because it's made them who they are. And they are, when I say they are the most beautiful, genuinely beautiful kids, they really, really are. And it's crazy. You were talking about like the broad range of the spectrum, like they're so opposites, like
right.
They are so opposites of the autism spectrum, like where one would have a meltdown, the other one would shut down. Do
yeah.
You know what I mean? One
yeah.
would be social, one would be very antisocial. Like, so there, one would be highly sensory, wouldn't be too sensory. So, like, and even then, the sensory needs are different. One would have like more sensory taste. And smells, the other one would be more touching. So it's like, it is different for
uh-huh.
every person.
And they're their
but
own people, as you said. You
make,
wouldn't change them
exactly.
for the world. How old are your children, do you mind me asking now, Rachel?
Now they are 14 and 16 now. And it's like even now, you know, I've actually think that if I had heard this at a really vulnerable time, because I did go through a few years where I just felt so awful. I felt like, oh, this was my fault. What did I do? I must have done something. And I think if I had heard that then, I think that could have really kind of put, I think it would have left me in a worse mental state, to be totally honest.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have been left more guilty, more, that feeling, it just would never have subsided to what it is now. Do you know that way? Like, I'm at a point, like, I've raised my kids to the way that their autism is superpowers. And it's always been a positive thing. Like they have super hearing, they have super taste, super senses, super kind of thing to try and make it a positive thing because I don't see it as a negative thing. now. Now, I will say when they were first born, I didn't understand it. Because before they were born, my perception of autism was, you know, like the film Rain Man?
Yeah, Dustin
so
Hoffman.
So that would have been, so that would have been my only kind of understanding and perception of autism at the time, until I had my son, and then like slowly over time, and then when I had my daughter, and slowly over time, learning about it and being aware of the different ranges, because I remember being approached about my daughter, and I was like, no, she can talk. She can talk. She's not autistic. So, I, you know, at the time, because my son didn't speak till he was nearly seven.
Right.
So I was really of the perception that it was just one way. So for me, it was a huge learning thing. And I have to say, they've been the best thing that has ever happened to me. I can honestly hand on my heart say that. They are the absolute best thing that has happened to me.
Good, good. And does that help you to maybe let some of that guilt go? So, Rachel?
Oh, yeah. No, like, I think for me, I think if you're a mother, even if there's no autism or anything there, you're going to feel guilty about something. Do you know what I mean? I think it's just being a mother kind of thing. You're guilty. If they're not in great form, you're going to feel guilty. I think it's that kind of level now. Do you know that way? It's not what it was. But I do think it's so dangerous. It's such a dangerous thing to come out with.
Okay.
With it. Like, people have been researching autism for years.
Mm-hmm.
For years. I genuinely think, like, these very same people, Donald Trump and his squad, we'll say, they only a few months ago were saying it was vaccines.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that, for them in such a short space of time to come to this conclusion.
More myths that have been debunked.
It's more about ego feeding rather than actually helping.
Now you're talking. Never mind the guilt, though. Their parents were always guilty, or maybe it's just an Irish thing as well. We're very good at guilt as well. But as a parent, we'll always feel guilty for something. Dr. Austin O'Carroll, I'm sure you can relate to that. Do you hear it coming into your surgery, women saying to you, I still feel guilty? Was it something I did?
I think that's just a general thing. I mean, I know myself as a parent. I feel, as I said earlier on, I think women are held to a higher account in our society.
Which, yeah.
I don't think it's right. But I think it's a natural tendency to aim towards that. I also think there's an important thing I think needs to be said. There's an implication by the fact that a drug causes autism or ADHD that somehow they are disorders or things. Whereas that's totally inconsistent with my understanding of the neurodivergence is that the way I understand ADHD and ASD, now I should clarify, severe autistic spectrum disorder with learning disability in particular is this really significant problem for people.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about the milder elements of the spectrum, we have a school system that expects kids to sit still for 8 hours a day and expects all kids to be sociable and chat and interact with each other the same as everyone else, as in sociable. And I think that actual expectations are totally false. There's many kids can't sit still. There's many kids don't like to socialise and have different ways of interacting. And the way I understand ADHD and autism is there's neurodivergence. We all have differences. We all have different brains. And the reason we need to tag people with these labels is because our system is so narrow, we need to get them to get services to fit into our system.
Yes.
So for people who are in school, we need to get support teacher, we need to give them more time in exams, we need to give them better ways of getting into college, etc., and more support, and at home in the more severe level. So, you know, the implication, if you take paracetamol, it causes this, implies it's somehow a disorder, where me, it's just a variation of normal. Except, I want to understand, because I understand parents of severely autistic children with severe autism and with particularly intellectual disability, it is a significant issue and moves more into that more difficult area. Yeah.
Can I ask you one final point, Austin, as a GP as well? Rachel mentioned that there could be young mothers or new parents out there worried about actually giving paracetamol to their children for a high fever. And well, we know how dangerous a high temperature can be as well. And I want to make sure people don't forget how good modern medicine has been. What would you say to those people about giving their children medication for a high temperature?
I think absolutely. First of all, what Trump said was nothing to do with children. It was totally false anyway.
Because, yes.
And it is absolutely, paracetamol is one of the safest drugs we know. It is really useful in children with high fever, because having high fevers is significantly difficult for children and dangerous. So bringing down that fever is really important. And paracetamol is the best drug we have for it. So same as, you know, there's all those there's the danger of not giving children paracetamol is dangerous. Same way as, you know, we still are living with the impact of people being fed misinformation about vaccines, and we're now getting measles and people dying from measles because of that misinformation. So we need to be really careful when people are coming out with these crazy stuff.
Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Austin O'Carroll there, and thanks to Rachel as well, sharing feelings that we, as parents, we all feel about guilt. But lovely to hear about your children that you're so proud of as well and wouldn't change for the world, as you said. We'll come back to more of your calls on this as well, if you want to get in touch. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Patricia Vaughan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, John.
Patricia, you're a woman in a hurry, and I don't think it's just because the school bell is about to go at Ferglan National School in County Clare, but you're afraid it might not be ringing at all soon.
Yes. But John, first of all, can I just say thank you so much for having me on your programme, and to all those other principals out there all over Ireland who are in the same position as myself, who are trying to keep their small schools open. I'm so grateful that you've given me the voice today to speak for all of those schools, not just for Ferglan.
Well, thanks for talking to us, but tell us a little bit more about your primary school.
So the position we're in now, John, at the moment, is we have seven children on roll as of this minute.
Seven.
The 23rd, seven children. We need 11 children on roll in a week's time. By the 30th of September, we need four more children. We have currently seven, so four more children to enroll in our school. And once we have our 11 children, that will secure our second teacher in the school, my wonderful deputy principal, Monica Deline. So
you have seven children in the school?
Seven children in the school.
Are you Ireland's smallest school at this stage, I wonder?
I don't think so. I would say there's probably schools in Ireland in the same boat, possibly maybe two or three less than us. I know that last year, John, eight schools in Ireland, none of them were in Clare, but eight schools in Ireland closed their doors for the final time. And, you know, not an awful lot was made about it.
Because of falling roll numbers, as you said. Maybe I'll put that one out there to the listeners as well. Liveline at rte.ie. I'd like to know if there's smaller schools than Ferglan National School in Clare, which has seven pupils, and you have two teachers, including yourself. Is that right?
Yes, I have my deputy principal, Monica. I have a special education teacher, that's Thomas. Now, he is shared, all right, with two other schools in the area. And then I also have an SNA, a full-time SNA, who's here until 3 o'clock, so full hours SNA. So we have a fantastic staff. And
you might be the envy of the country for those pupil-teacher ratios.
But fantastic pupil-teacher
ratios. Was it always this way, Patricia?
Well, I'll be honest with you, it hasn't always been this way, but in the past 4 or 5 years now, it has been coming this way. 12 years ago, we had 48 children, and we had fantastic numbers. We had seven families with three children in the school, with 21 of our children were in seven families. But all of those families now have moved on. We're not in a position where the house is being built all around us, and we're really feeling it hard here. The houses aren't being built, the children aren't there. There's a shortage of accommodation in the Enniskillen Lahinch area. We're in the parish of Enniskillen, and that's the position we're in. As a result of that, now, over the last 3 or 4 years, we had, we'd say, 15 down to 13, then we went down to 11. Last year, we actually went up to 12. So we were one over the threshold. But we lost three children into secondary school. And that was a quarter of our enrolment, John. Can you imagine losing a quarter of your enrolment, which is what happened to us?
Mm-hmm.
And it has put us in this position. It's been very difficult even to come on here on air with you. This day, that's Wednesday, our board of management came together. We sat down for 2 hours around the table and we said, what are we going to do about it? And the biggest thing we all said is we're not going to go without a fight. And we're going to fight really, really hard. And we decided to go public. For the last 2 or 3 years, we haven't been brave enough to go public, because sometimes if you go public, it draws negative attention on you. Your numbers are small, or there's a danger of closing. But last Wednesday, when our board came together, we said, you know what? we're going to be open and we're going to make a call out and we're going to appeal. There are families out there, John. We do know that. There are families out there, not families that have children enrolled in another school. I'm not looking for those children. I'm looking for children maybe who had been homeschooled and now their parents consider sending their children into a primary school. I'm looking for children maybe 4 or 5 years of age who are not enrolled in any school. I'm looking for parents, we'll say, who've come back from abroad, parents who've travelled from a different part of the country, who've decided to relocate here. I suppose that's okay, who I'm really appealing to.
Patricia, time is ticking for you, though. You have a week, is it?
It is. We have 1 week.
1 week, because you need to have your role. You need to have your enrolment figures. Is that right? By next Tuesday.
Today week.
For the Department of Education.
I need to have 4 more pupils enrolled. But you know, John.
And if you don't have them,
we're fighting hard. If it doesn't happen, John, well, I'm very positive that it will happen. I want to say that.
Okay.
First.
Okay. Well, then look. Give you a fighting chance, I'm thinking, Patricia, you're going to need some of those pupils from the neighbouring schools. Are there other schools far away? Because most people will have their children in school by now or know where they're going maybe next year. You're hoping that 4 more might appear out of somewhere, but you might need them from some of the neighbouring schools. Are there other choices nearby?
I'm in the parish of Innistown. Fergla National School is in the parish of Innistown. We have some fantastic schools in the area. There are other schools. But I'm making this very clear, John, and I've made this very clear. I am not looking for children from other schools. There are children out there that are 4 or 5 that have not enrolled in a school.
Okay.
There are parents who have travelled from other parts of Ireland who are living. That's who I'm making the appeal to, and that's very important to me.
And I hear what you're saying.
Very important to my school, very important to my board of management as well, and very important to my parent body, and very important to my community. When I came on here today, John, the first thing I said is, I'm not the only principal that's in this position. There are lots of other principals in the same position, maybe with bigger schools, but they're trying to fight for their teacher. So I am very conscious about that.
I hear what you're saying completely, conscious. And I'm sure you all work closely together and respect each other. Yes, what I was trying to get to, Patricia, was you mentioned there is negative attention sometimes when a school speaks out in this way. And I was wondering, do you mean that maybe some people have opted to send their children to bigger schools because they don't like the idea of going to such a small school? Because, for instance, you have 7 children. Are they split across junior infants up to 6th class?
Yes, 2 classrooms, yes.
And some people might prefer to have their children in a school with a lot of kids their own age, or maybe they think it sets them up better for secondary school. Do you hear those kind of concerns?
We hear all of that. But I can tell you this, John, I have 3 boys and they came to school. I sent them here to Fergla National School. And I'll tell you, I have a pair of twins and they left me this year in 6th class and they got into the new community school in Innistown. And I'll tell you, if you ask their teachers inside there, they can tell you that those children are thriving. Because children that come from small schools, they thrive in secondary. Because of the attention they have been getting, because of the specialised teaching they've been getting, because of the one-to-one, they also make friends. We're like a little family here. And any school that has numbers in single digits will tell you that. We're like a little family. So there's never a problem making friends. Because they're all friendly with each other. We have 6th-class children that are friendly with children in 2nd. We have 3rd-class children that are friendly with children in 1st. All of the children here make... That definitely wouldn't be a reason not to send your child here.
But I'm just thinking, as a parent, it might be something people ask you about. They might think it's an awful culture shock for their kids to go from a school of 7 children where you might have had nobody of the same age as you into your brand new community school, as you said there in Innistimon.
Yes, and I do agree about all that. But what I am saying, John, is that the children who leave here, and I have 2 of them, my twin boys, they're 2 of the 3 I sent in this year, that they're able to stand tall, that they're able to hold their ground, and they're independent, they're willing to make friends, and they're confident. And that's the result of the amount of time they have got here in Fergan with my fantastic staff. And I really go back again to my staff. The support I have, John, here is just second to none. Mm-hmm. And my school is a school, it's family-based. And that's any school with small numbers will tell you that they're family-based. We have parents here that would do anything for me. They go above and beyond to help me. But perhaps in the last number of years, and you did mention it there, that people might be a little bit slow to send their children to a smaller school. And I suppose that's why we didn't speak out. We didn't speak out about our numbers, John. We didn't go around. Even in our social media, we send the lovely pictures of the all having fun in the yard. They're going in their fabulous tours. We took them to Emerald Park last year. We always have exceptionally exciting
lovely
tours here.
So
lots
you feel,
of opportunities there.
Patricia, you feel that more than people choosing not to go to a smaller school, though it's a sort of a rural depopulation issue whereby people haven't come to where you are.
Absolutely. And I suppose, too, you know, there's so many people coming into North Clare. We have quite, in a Stymon Lahinch, it's a beautiful part of the world, as
it
you know.
It certainly is. I love
it's
it very
absolutely
much.
Absolutely. It's beautiful, and I'm privileged to have been born and raised here in Enniskillen.
And I'm only a blow into that part of the world as well, Patricia, but privileged to be a blow in too, yeah.
Yes, well, I'm privileged to have been born and bred here. And I am very proud of our local community. I'm very proud of Dennis Diamond, my Hinch local community. I'm very proud of what we have to offer. And I'm especially proud of my school. I wouldn't be here, John, speaking to you if I felt I didn't have confidence in getting those children. I wouldn't. Because in the last number of years, what we kind of did was we put our heads down and we kind of said, you know what, we look out the window now and they'll be in the door now tomorrow and they'll be in the door the following day. And they, you know, they didn't. So we waited really until last Wednesday night to have our emergency board meeting.
Okay,
because it's not easy going public, John.
Oh, of course, of course.
How many principals have you had on in the last number of years that are fighting for survival? Mm-hmm. Not for my staff and my children, but for our community.
It's very interesting. No, it's very interesting to hear from you on this, Patricia.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, because I know the North Clare area has been extremely welcoming to a lot of new people, be they blow-ins, as I mentioned, or people who have come from other countries or have had to come here through war and other situations in their countries in Ukraine or in other parts of the world.
Yes.
I wonder, is that an option for you? Are there people looking for school places in that way?
Well, that's what I'm hoping for, John, you know, because we are, you know, it is a rural school. It is, we're 3 or 4 miles from the closest town. You know, a lot of people may not have heard about us, but you know something? They're hearing about us now. And we're doing a major appeal through social media and through the radio and through even television today with TG Carr, we're here filming us today. We'll be going out tonight. And I think it's an important issue, John. It's important.
Okay,
it's my
time
story
is ticking
today. It's someone else's tomorrow.
Time is ticking, Patricia. And as you mentioned as well, the loss of the school would be a loss to your local community as well, not just to children and their parents as
absolutely
well, because I know it's the last social hub in many communities as well. It's
of
the
course
school gate is so important, and young people so important to keep life in a local community. Make
absolutely
your pitch. So 1 week to go, how can they get in touch, and what are you hoping to hear from our listeners?
So all of your listeners there today, please, you've heard me speak there for the last 5 or 6 minutes. You know what I need. I need 4 children in the next week. That's 7 days, by the 30th of September. Please, if you know anybody who has moved into Dennis Diamond, North Clare area, please can you get them to touch base with us, to ring us, or to come personally to the school. Our door is open. Our gates are open. Our gates are always open. And please, the North Clare community is always very supportive, and I have no doubt but they will come behind us and they will get us over the line.
I was going to ask you what happens if you don't succeed, but Patricia, I don't think you've even considered that right now.
We haven't even considered it, and it's not part of anything that I wouldn't be here now, John, if I was considering that. I am putting everything into this.
I admire your spirit, and fair play to you. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Let us know how you get on. Patricia
Vaughan
there in Ferglan National School in County Clare. You're very welcome. Do get in touch. Our Liveline at rte.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Time is ticking as well, not only for the national school there in Ferglan that we were hearing about so passionately from Patricia, but also for the race to be a candidate in the presidential election. Maria Steen edging closer, but time will tell what happens between now and the close of nominations, the deadline at 12 o'clock tomorrow. So right now, there could be four candidates running for the Oras. We've only three guaranteed for now. Betty, good afternoon to you.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm very well, and thanks for talking to us on Liveline today. Would you know what they all look like, the presidential candidates that you've heard confirmed anyway yet?
I have a fair idea, John. They're on the telly every time you turn it on. They're all over social media, television, yes.
Okay, yeah, so you've already seen their faces out there. Do you want to see them up on election posters, up on polls around your area and around the country?
Not particularly, John. No. I really don't think it does any good whatsoever. It's a bit like a governmental Tinder, you know. Sort of swipe right, swipe left, and there's not many of them you'd be bothered swiping one way or the other.
Governmental Tinder. We've heard it from you first, Betty. I hope you get that
there
rolling
you are,
soon.
John. Not that I know a whole lot about Tinder now.
Betty, that's a whole other story. Do you want to tell me about that?
That's another story. No. I'm married for 47 years to the same lad, so let's leave that there.
I'm thinking you didn't bother with Tinder, so, but...
No. Adamstown Ballroom, that was our Tinder.
Things were more
of romance,
things
John.
Were more direct, weren't they?
Jesus, was it? Look, when you think of it, like, you mean, you got asked up for a dance by some fella, and it wasn't manners to refuse him, no matter what he was like. He could have his hobnail boots on him, or God knows what.
There was no swiping left or right there, or looking the other way.
No, you just got up and got on with it, and refused the next dance if you weren't happy. So that was the swipe left, swipe right, I guess.
Would you have managed it in Tinder? I often think I wouldn't manage nowadays at all.
Oh, Jesus, no. I'd get a dog.
I don't know if that's if you're slagging off some of the faces you've seen on Tinder there, or if you're looking for a pet instead. Life might be quieter, Betty, and there's good and bad to that.
Absolutely.
Governmental Tinder, so aside, the election posters. Do you know what? Tomorrow the campaign kicks off proper, doesn't it? We're in the race for the Oras. You do want to get people interested in the election. We're in a democracy. We want people to have their say. Doesn't the posters kind of give you that feeling that there's something going on and remind you to get voting and have a think about it, have a chat about it with your friends?
Well, I suppose if you lived in a big dark cave somewhere and you only came out once or twice a year. But we're all linked up to social media, and there's so many different formats of media nowadays. Like years ago, you were depending on the posters. Like the candidates would have been depending on the posters to have their faces recognised.
Yes.
But they really don't need them anymore. And with the whole environmental issues that we're all experiencing nowadays, do we need all this unrecyclable plastic? I mean, I have looked at the roundabout here in Rosslare Harbour at one stage. There was multiples of about 9 of each candidate. You had this competition going on where everybody would put up one poster, and all of a sudden somebody might put up 2. And the next thing they'll come back and put up more and more, and it becomes a complete circus.
And someone took down somebody's posters and somebody covered someone else up. It gets, it's really dog eat dog there then.
Yeah, but look, realistically, it's an absolute circus. And I feel myself, apart from the environmental issue and the damage of the plastic posters and that are not recyclable, there's also like the visual pollution as well. Waste of resources. A huge amount of money is spent on these posters that could be put to far better use. And then, of course, you have the knock-on effect of local authorities having to do clean-ups. You get all these cable ties left on lampposts. You get posters blowing off the lampposts and blowing down cliffs and onto ditches, into fields. You know, it's just an absolute nightmare, really.
And do you not think the politicians have got better or more environmentally aware that they do actually come out, or their groups, their teams come out and take down the posters responsibly again?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I took particular note in this, I'm just talking about Wexford now in general. Like, we managed, the last election, we managed to have no posters in Kilran, Rosslare Harbour Village, because we very respectfully emailed all the candidates, and anyone who had posters up, we asked them to remove them. Obviously, we would never dream of removing posters. They have a right to put the posters
up. Okay, you asked them to take them down.
No, you wouldn't do that. But all the candidates came back and removed their posters.
Okay.
So, and they were very, very good. They were very respectful to us as well. We did ask them very nicely. We emailed everybody. But I really feel that, like, there are many villages that are poster-free. Tidy Towns groups have decided that they're going to be election poster-free villages.
Are you going to be poster-free for this presidential election in Rosslare?
Well, that's our aim. I'm already preparing emails to send out to the different parties and candidates to respectfully ask them not to put posters up in our village of Rosslare Harbour in Kilran.
Okay, let's see how it goes. I'd love to hear our listeners feel in other areas of the country too. 51551 for your texts. Already people are getting in touch. I think they enjoyed the idea of governmental Tinder there, and they're saying, Betty for president. What do you think, Betty?
Oh, yes, let's do it.
12 o'clock tomorrow, time is ticking for you as well. 51551 for your texts.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, we started the programme with lots of you getting in touch on those outrageous and unfounded claims made about paracetamol. But I want to go to a very real health warning now and a call for a ban on flavoured vapes. Professor Marcus Kennedy, thanks for joining me on Liveline today. How are you?
Good, and you?
Very well, thank you very much. And vaping, well, the debate goes on, but you were very worried about what it's doing to teenagers, to young people in particular, and their brains.
Yes, so as you stated, there is a release today as regards the impact of vaping on teenagers. The concentration of nicotine in vapes is very high, and we know that nicotine is damaging to the teenagers or the developing brain, probably as long-term issues, but also short-term issues as regards agitation, sleep, and withdrawal from nicotine. Leads to irritation and potentially aggression because the concentration is so high. Other issues it can have for teenagers and for all of us include heart and lung issues. So our target is really to get the message across to teenagers to not start vaping.
And we know for many years people saw vaping as maybe the lesser of evils or a way of not smoking. I know your concern is that vaping leads to smoking cigarettes for younger people starting out now. And I'm thinking a lot of people out there will be saying, well, doesn't it depend what I have in my vape or what flavour I'm using?
Yeah, so you've mentioned as regards smokers and maybe risk reduction. So the argument is that vapes are probably safer than smoking traditional cigarettes. So we know all the damage that traditional cigarettes do. We have 100 years of research. We have, you know, clearly one in two smokers, unfortunately, are dying of a smoking-related lung disease. The jury is out yet on folks who vape alone. Really, we need to follow people for about 40 years to see exactly what the outcome is going to be. But short-term studies on animal models, but also in humans, show that they are detrimental. So one of the issues, I guess, that tobacco companies have pushed here is the misnomer of vape. So this is not a vape. So vape, you know, we think of the kettle boiling. However, this is really an aerosol, like a deodorant or a spray. Mm-hmm. They contain multiple toxins, including propylene glycol, that's an antifreeze, acetone and nail polish, ethyl benzene and paint and pesticide. And for formaldehyde and embalming. So this is a mixture of toxins that is inhaled.
Antifreeze, also, formaldehyde.
Yes.
I heard you mention nail varnish, car exhaust fumes. Are they really all this bad, though? That's what I'm wondering. Do people think there are better or worse flavours to use here, or that they need to be concerned about all of them?
So as regards flavours, issues include side effects of flavours. For instance, the cherry flavour is extremely toxic. That's benzaldehyde. The cinnamon flavour, if you have enough concentration of it, will erode plastic at high concentration. However, the other issue as regards flavours is that they are very attractive, you know. So for kids smoking these, you get a flavour of some of these nice, sweet associations. And we know colours and flavours really attract younger people towards vapes as opposed to tobacco. Now,
Okay.
The question also arises, are they safer than smoking? And, you know, the pro-vaping lobby would suggest they're 90% safer, 95% safer. But if one in two smokers unfortunately die of smoking cigarettes, you could argue then that 5 to 10% of vapers could die in the future of vaping.
It's where I have to leave it for today, Professor Marcus Kennedy, but he is calling for a ban on all flavoured vapes. And you're going to see this information be distributed to your teenagers throughout secondary schools throughout the country ahead of World Lung Day. That's later this week.